I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media.
Season 4 of How We Win is here.
For the past 4 years, we've been making history in critical elections all over the country. And last year, we made history again by expanding our majority in the Senate, beating election-denying Republicans in crucial state House races, and fighting back a non-existent red wave.
But the MAGA Republicans who plotted and pardoned the attempted overthrow of our government now control the House, thanks to gerrymandered maps and repressive anti-voter laws. And the chaotic spectacle we've already seen shows us just how far they will go to seize power, dismantle our government, and take away our freedoms.
So, the official podcast of The Persistence is back with Season 4. There's so much more important work ahead of us to fight for equity, justice, and our very democracy itself. We'll take you behind the lines and inside the rooms where it happens with strategy and inspiration from progressive changemakers all over the country.
And we'll dig deep into the weekly news that matters most and what you can do about it with messaging and communications expert, co-founder of Way to Win, and our new co-host, Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
So join Steve and I every Wednesday for your weekly dose of inspiration, action, and hope.
I'm Steve Pearson.
And I'm Jennifer Fernandez Ancona.
And this is How We Win.
Thanks to MedCline for supporting Cleanup on Aisle 45. If you suffer from shoulder pain or nighttime acid reflux or both, then MedCline might be right for you. So get 20% off and a better night's sleep today at MedCline.com/cleanup.
The rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, one rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's cleanup on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be cleanup on aisle 45.
Hey, everybody. It is Wednesday, September 14th, 2022, and this is episode 87 of Clean Up on Aisle 45. I am your co-host, Andrew Torres. AG is in parts unknown, conferring with the highest levels of government. Actually, I'm not entirely sure where she is, but sitting in for AG today is the lovely and talented Liz Dye. You know her from her work at Wonkette. She also writes at Above the Law. She is incredibly snarky on Twitter. Is there anything else that I need to plug for you, Liz?
I don't think so. I think that about covers it.
Excellent. Well, welcome to the show and thanks for being here with us today.
Glad to be here.
All right. So let's get into it. We will thank patrons next week. This week, what I really, really want to talk about is the spectacular crashing and burning of everybody who has ever been close to Donald Trump for any reason whatsoever. They lived high on the hog for a while. The grift was good while the getting was easy, but now maybe not so much. So let's talk about, you want to start with Dr. Peter Navarro?
Dr. Peter Navarro, economist extraordinaire. Well,
I never want to hear them make fun of Dr. Jill Biden again. But
oh my
anyway.
God! Right? Exactly.
Yeah. So, who is Peter Navarro?
Well, so Peter Navarro is an economist, but he he's run for office in California a whole bunch of times. Sometimes as a Democrat, never successfully. Most recently as a Republican, and. When Jared Kushner was looking to staff up the Trump administration, he literally went to Amazon looking for someone who would reinforce Trump's kind of childish ideas about trade wars with China being good and easy to win. Somebody who was going to say, China bad, we're going to, tariff ourselves into, equipoise. But so those ideas were silly.
Yes.
And Peter Navarro had them. And he also had a bunch of other really stupid ideas. But, good enough. So he was with Trump the whole 4 years in various economic advisory positions in the White House. But also he had his fingers in a lot of other pies because he had boundless confidence in his own kind of intellectual ability. So he was involved in the coronavirus response, and that's how we wound up with tens of millions of doses of hydroxychloroquine in the property of the U.S. government, but none for patients with like lupus who actually needed them. And toward the end,
to be fair, any idiot economist could have made that mistake. So
true. Don't want to diss you unnecessarily, Dr. Navarro. He also sort of, at the end, purported to have statistically proved that Trump could not have lost the election using his big brain and math. The whole thing was like garbage. The theory was that Trump couldn't have done so much less well in the mail-in ballots, and Biden couldn't have overperformed in the mail-in ballots such that it would have flipped the tallies overnight from Trump to right. It was really silly. Like, everybody had predicted that,
despite peer-reviewed literature predating and predicting exactly what happened. Right? Like,
exactly.
There was a reason. I don't think CNN coined the blue shift effect.
Right.
On
the red wave.
Election
right,
night.
Right.
Right. Like, yeah.
So he had this kind of manifesto, which purported to prove that the thing was stolen, and. He decided he was going to keep Trump in office using his, his bigly man brain. And he kind of hooked up with Steve Bannon in this plot, which they called the Green Bay Sweep, which is apparently after a Packers blocking play. I only knew this when I was researching the show. I thought it was, because there's all of these swing states and the last one in the alphabet was Wisconsin. Apparently it's a blocking play because they're such manly men. You could tell if you've ever seen Peter Navarro.
Or Steve Bannon.
Bannon. Picture of manliness and health.
It is not like he is an Adonis come down to earth. But anyway, yeah.
Pot for every lid, man.
I like football just fine. So, there's no need to,
All right.
The Packers are hurting after this past weekend. But anyway.
Right. So they hooked up with 100 Republican legislators, actually more than. And they had this plan. And their plan, this Green Bay Sweep plan, was to create such a ruckus by objecting to the swing state legislators, the electoral college slates, on January 6th, like in the chamber, and outside the chamber would be this pitchfork mob of lunatics, which they had summoned for the purpose. And some sort of way they were going to delay certification long enough, or they were going to block it, and Trump was going to be president, right? It was like kind of an underpants gnome thing. So
yeah. Is there any evidence connecting them at all to any of Trump's legal team, John Eastman or the folks that were putting together like the flimsy paper thin justifications for ostensibly doing so? Or
I
just
haven't
a crazy coincidence
seen that,
right?
Although, no. I haven't seen that, but I would be surprised if they kind of magically alit on this legal theory on their own.
Right, yeah.
Neither man being a lawyer.
Right, exactly. Obviously Renaissance man, Dr. Peter Navarro, but still.
Who has represented himself in court to hilarious effect.
Oh, good. Yeah, well, we will get to that. Okay, so they're coming up with sort of the boots on the ground implementation of the John Eastman, you know, well, at minimum, maybe we can just delay the Electoral Count Act and send it back. Okay.
Right. And Bannon was pretty clear. They were both pretty clear about what they were doing. Bannon on January 5th famously said, all hell is going to break loose tomorrow. And Navarro said, you know, Biden's never going to be inaugurated. And he even wrote a book about it called In Trump Time, My Journal of America's Plague Year. I'm sure everybody who's listening is
ready. Yeah, it's on my bookshelf, but I'll get to it.
I got the audio version. I just really wanted to hear it. Read it to me. Anyway, so they weren't secret. They weren't shy about what they were doing. But when they were subpoenaed by Congress, both of them basically gave two big middle fingers to the January 6th Select Committee and said that they couldn't possibly talk about it because of Trump's invocation of executive privilege. And to be fair, a lot of people said that.
Sure, but multiple things, right? Number one, a lot of people took that approach. You know, Don McGahn managed to ride out the string by, doing so while Trump was in office. And, that delay worked. Like, your guy's not there anymore. Anyway, so.
Well, I mean, and not just that there have been hundreds and hundreds of witnesses, and a lot of them kind of didn't wind up cooperating, but nobody did it in such an egregiously stupid way as these two geniuses. Right.
John Eastman showed up and then just, said fifth to literally everything, right?
Mike Flynn showed up. Hey, I mean, Roger Stone showed up. Alex Jones showed up. And part of the reason that they showed up is that, that Bannon got indicted early and it looked and then they were like, oh, I guess the DOJ is actually going to, deal with this. But these two did not show up and did not produce any documents. And, they got the sharp end of the indictment. Like, no kidding, dude. So Bannon handled it in a slightly different way from Navarro. He, through his lawyer, Robert Costello, told the January 6th committee that Trump had invoked executive privilege and that he wasn't going to show up to all. And there was some negotiation where Bannon's, where Costello showed up. And we, probably listeners of your show recognize Costello because he's got a long history. He's represented Rudy Giuliani. And he, if you remember in the prior incantation of this fun soap opera, he was the one who theoretically dangled a pardon to Michael Cohen using Garth Brooks lyrics. Like he's been around. He's a wild character. Like he did work at the Southern District of New York, like 100 years ago, but I don't know what happened to these guys. They all got brainwashed.
Rudy Giuliani, we went back to look at the 793 E and F episodes that I had recorded in 2016. And the person with credibility affiliated with the Trump transition team was Rudy Giuliani in 2016. So,
and it's all been downhill since then.
Yeah, it's all been decomposing at Four Seasons Total Landscaping.
As has poor Rudy.
Yeah. Okay.
So Costello.
To be clear. I want to talk about Costello, but to be clear, Steve Bannon, not in the White House, not employed by Donald Trump in any way.
No,
Steve Bannon any of the events leading up to 2020.
Got booted out of the White House in 2017. Yeah. And, he got the infamous nasty Trump tweet. I think they called him Sloppy Steve or whatever. He was, I think he got fired after he spoke
to Little Marco. But
No, he's in a Little Marco. I think he spoke to, I think Michael Wolff, and he said he was talking about they were going to break Don Jr. like an egg on national television or something if he was ever interviewed by Congress. Anyway, he got booted in 2017. And so his claim of executive privilege was preposterous on its face because, he was not a high-ranking executive branch official having, official communications with the president. He was talking about how to overturn the election. So Costello went to Congress and said, basically, get bent. And he also went to the Justice Department after the committee referred Bannon for contempt prosecution and said, no, you can't prosecute my guy because he has this privilege claim from the former president via his lawyer, Justin Clark. But that turned out to be kind of maybe less than 100% accurate, maybe like 100% less than 100% accurate, because in the subsequently produced communications, Justin Clark, well, I mean, I can read it to you. It's he says, just to reiterate, our letter didn't indicate that we believe there is immunity from testimony for your client. As I indicated to you the other day, we don't believe there is. Now, you may have made a different determination. That is entirely your call. So Clark didn't invoke privilege on Trump's behalf.
That's the opposite of that.
Right. I mean, what he had said was made, and this is, I believe this is kind of how Meadows and a bunch of the other Trump land people got kind of snookered by Trump, that Trump's lawyers made a kind of general statement like, protect all the privileges that you have. And people interpreted that rather expansively. Bannon and Navarro interpreted it extremely expansively, and they paid the price, right? So Justin Clark had said something like, I think you have some privilege, you should assert it, by which Bannon took that to mean, I can just tell you guys to get bent and not give you any documents and not show up to testify. And that was a bad choice.
Yeah, and we should say, I think you are correct to point out the DOJ's decision, right? So Congress then immediately referred Bannon, and immediately, it took a couple of weeks,
right.
But referred Bannon to the DOJ for prosecution under 2 USC 192. This, again, misdemeanor, right? Punishable by a fine of not more than $1,000, nor, you know, jail from 1 to 12 months. But nevertheless, like, that is the penalty that Congress has put into place for witnesses who refuse to testify pursuant to a valid subpoena to appear before Congress. We saw the sort of Steve Bannon claiming, you know, that the Alex Jones, like, well, I don't know, what am I supposed to put on in my defense? And the answer is, well, probably not anything when it's this clear that you're that guilty. But yeah.
Right. Right.
Why don't we talk a little bit about Bannon's trial? Like,
That trial was wild. He was represented by your buddy, Evan the Cork Corcoran, and David Schoen, who represented Trump in the second impeachment.
Famously sleepy David Schoen, who told rambling stories and prompted Donald Trump to tell. Was he telling a GW law professor, Jonathan Turley, one of his flacks, like, who the hell is that guy? Which was great. Yeah. That David Schoen, if you are still kind of putting the pieces together.
Right.
I love that one. He had the, like, people were doing the, you know, Grandpa Simpson, like, so I tied an onion to my belt, which was in the style at the time. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. All right.
He is a styling guy. So, right. So they tried to put on a whole bunch of what in my writing are referred to as permission slip defenses. They tried an advice of counsel defense, which is Bannon said, well, my lawyer said it was cool. So I had a rational belief that I could, you know, just tell the committee to get bent.
And does that work?
It actually doesn't. In fact, there is precedent in the in D.C., in federal court in D.C., which says that you can't do that. And it's from a case called Licavoli versus the United States. He tried that. It did not work. He tried to claim, he tried to claim that the Office of Legal Counsel memoranda, which he naturally was poring over every night to familiarize himself with before he, you know, gave two middle fingers to Congress, said that the Justice Department would not prosecute a federal, an executive branch employee or a former executive branch employee who was claiming executive privilege. The problem was, and he pointed to, like, Don McGahn. And Don McGahn did manage to escape testimony in some measure. The problem was that Don McGahn was being asked to testify about stuff that happened as a part of his official duties when he was a White House employee. Bannon was not. Right. Bannon wanted to kind of foment a coup and then claim executive privilege because he had once had, like, a White House hall pass. And that's, you know, not a thing. Yep. So that didn't work. And it's not going to work for Navarro, who's trying the same thing. Like, Bannon got convicted in July on both counts of contempt of Congress, one count for refusing to testify and one count for refusing to produce documents.
Okay. So, and again, I know you know this and are sort of well prepared to talk about it. I know our listeners probably know it. Bannon also raised the laundry list of arguments that we keep seeing getting recycled in these January 6th cases that begins with, you know, the president has absolute immunity. No, he doesn't. He's lost every case in which he's argued that. Well, the 1-6 committee was not duly constituted. Yes, it was. And by the way, the House gets to set its own rules. Well, then it doesn't have subpoena power. Yes, it does. And that goes back to the founding of the Constitution, right? Like, it's, there's a grab bag of just unbelievable, terrible arguments.
Right. Yeah. You don't have subpoena power because Liz Cheney doesn't count as a ranking member and you're not my real daddy. It's nonsense. Every one of these plaintiffs, and there's been many, many, many people who have sued. Alex Jones sued, Mike Flynn sued, Mark Meadows sued. Like, none of this is working. None of those have won. And John Eastman, for one, got totally slapped down on this, as did Bannon, that Judge Nichols, a Trump appointee, Judge Carl John Nichols in the U.S. District Court in D.C., wasn't entertaining any of this bullshit. So, you know. Anyway, so he wasn't allowed to present any of those defenses. And so his argument was basically like, you know, you guys are mean, you suck. And like, it didn't work. He got convicted in July. And now Navarro is facing the exact same charges because he is also an idiot.
So why would you run the same playbook
that
resulted in a, you know, double-barreled conviction for your buddy Steve?
Well, if you don't have anything else, I mean, what else is he going to say? You know, they kind of have him. He kind of didn't show up. So he's trying to, once again, assert some version of this, like, I don't have the scienter requirement. I don't have the mens rea to have committed the crime because I thought I had the right to tell you guys, you know, to piss off. But as Licavoli, and there's the Licavoli precedent, and there's all of this other stuff. Like, that's not a thing. Contempt of Congress doesn't depend on you thinking that you had to be there. In fact, Navarro go ahead.
We should be clear, the way in which this is just ordinary day one, year one, crim pro, I guess substantive crim law, law school stuff. The way in which you manifest mens rea is by intending to do the thing that you did, right? So you don't have to intend to refuse to show up to testify for Congress because you hate Congress and there's no specific intent requirement. You just have to have deliberately not shown up in connection with your subpoena. You know,
but if you think your testimony is scheduled for a Thursday and it's actually on a Tuesday and you fail to show up, well, you didn't have the intent requirement to blow off Congress.
Exactly right.
If you think, Liz Cheney is mean and I don't have to, that's not going to cut it.
So a couple of things that are important here. Navarro's trial is before rising superstar, and I need to always say this. I'm not trying to like climb into his shadow, but my former partner Amit Mehta from Zuckerman Spader. You can take my commendation of his legal skills with a grain of salt, but I think he has proven himself to be somebody on the rise, and somebody who has not been shy about wading into the Trump fray and sort of parsing out the nonsense in 200 page opinions that, you know, leave absolutely no room for doubt. Mm-hmm. It looks like the argument they are raising that Navarro is raising right now is a malicious prosecution kind of argument. They keep circulating a dissent from Brett Kavanaugh that says a former president must be able to successfully invoke the presidential communications privilege for communications that occurred during his presidency, I think they know the dissent is the side that lost, but like, I don't even know.
Right. It was the obiter from the denial of hearing.
Yeah. From the denial of granting injunctive relief. Right. Mm-hmm. So it is, as you point out, dicta on the shadow docket for relief that Kavanaugh wanted and lost on.
Right.
And all it says is that you must be able to invoke the privilege for those communications, which, by the way, like at that level of resolution, I don't disagree with that. Right. Like former presidents certainly have some right to invoke the presidential communications privilege with their trusted advisors. That seems fine to me. That does not mean everybody who's ever wandered into your orbit while you're committing crimes gets immunity for those crimes.
And it's consistent, that interpretation is consistent with the stance that the Trump administration took the entire time, where they claimed a magical cloak of immunity for everything that took place in the executive branch. And Pat Cipollone, who is, you know, testifying now, blessed that.
Yep. Yeah, no, and I love, we're going to do this slight rabbit trail because I love pointing that out, that the folks who are cooperating and testifying now, like our good buddy Patsy Baloney and Steve Engel, like these people are still monsters, right? We just found the one line they wouldn't cross, right? And the one line apparently they would not cross was making Jeff Clark Attorney General of the United States. But everything else was still fair game.
Right. They told House Oversight to get bent for 4 straight years. So
yep, exactly right. So I'm glad you point that out. We have to, like, I don't know your view on this. Like I think that Liz Cheney demonstrated like legitimate what passes for courage in the electoral world. Like I have some respect for, again, her political positions are horrible, but like I have genuine respect for that. But like when they're lauding Mike Pence, who could show up tomorrow and testify about this, like give me a fucking break, right?
Oh, completely. And right, the fact that you did one good thing doesn't mean that you didn't spend 4 years running interference for a criminal, right? We all were there for the first impeachment and the second impeachment. Like, we saw what happened there. You guys buried, I mean, Pat Cipollone and Bill Barr, they all buried what Trump did. Trump tried to extort the leader of a foreign country for dirt on Joe Biden, and they did their very best to make sure no one ever found out about it. So,
yep, absolutely, 100%. So, okay, it strikes me, kind of steel-botting the other side, it strikes me as not an implausible argument to say, all right, maybe I've said this in a dumb way, but like, I do seem to be the only guy you're prosecuting for this. And lots of other people have told you to go fuck yourself. So why am I the one who's staring down the barrel of, you know, a cold 12 months in a posh country club prison at worst?
I mean, that's an interesting, but kind of you don't get to ask it type question, right? Because that's not what malicious prosecution is, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. Way to sort of point through my examples there. But look, it is particularly galling as someone who wrote an amicus brief in connection with the Michael Flynn decision that for 4 years while they were in power, the Trump administration believed in absolute prosecutorial discretion, even when a defendant had confessed multiple times that they believed in the case of Michael Flynn, that they could later turn around and drop that case for I don't know what. Like, there is zero plausible Rule 45 reason that you could have dropped the case against Michael Flynn, which is why we filed our amicus in that case. But no, you do not show selective prosecution by saying other folks were prosecuted for this offense under similar circumstances any more than that works when the cop pulls you over and you say, yeah, but you know, they were all going 80 and I was only going 75. So yeah.
Right. And even if he had a case for it, which he very clearly, he Bannon or he Navarro in the current situation, they're not going to be able to argue it. I mean, if Judge Nichols wasn't going to let, right. So Bannon had hoped, he said he was going to make this the misdemeanor from hell for Biden and Nancy Pelosi and Merrick Garland, because he thought he was going to use his prosecution to kind of extort all of this really damaging discovery from Congress and the Justice Department and the White House. But like, he wasn't, because that's just not a thing. You know, there's the speech or debate clause to protect congressional communications and work product privilege and all of the other prosecutorial privileges. He was not able to kind of leverage his prosecution to get all of this discovery on internal Justice Department communications on why they did they didn't prosecute Dan Scavino or Mark Meadows, Mark Meadows being Trump's chief of staff and Dan Scavino being his comms flack who like types out some of his nasty tweets or whatever. He used to be his golf caddy. In the case of Meadows, you can kind of make a guess, though, right? Because Meadows did in some wise cooperate and turned over all those thousands of texts and, you know, did not wind up testifying, but also did in some wise cooperate.
Yeah. Did Scavino turn over any documents to the January 6th committee?
It appears that he did not, but
okay.
He also did engage the committee in some wise with his lawyer. No one knows, really, right? Like, we don't have the discovery either. We don't know why the Justice Department decided not to go after Scavino and Meadows, although they appear to have kind of stayed in their lane in some fashion and weren't so crazy. Like, they didn't, well, I guess Meadows did write a book about it, too. But whatever the reason, Bannon wasn't able to get discovery, and Navarro is making the same arguments in front of Judge Mehta, attempting to extort discovery on this malicious prosecution thing because he's, I don't know, they're a member of a protected class of weirdos named Doctor. I don't know.
I think Meadows is going to flip. I flip back, do at least enough. And the way that I've kind of analyzed that is if you look at the public January 6th committee hearings, they've basically given him the like hero way out, right? Like they have deliberately lumped him in with the folks who are going to get the hero edit out of this. But they have documents and they've gone selectively through those documents that show that Meadows was there at ground zero. And I think there's a carrot and stick, but you seem to disagree. I want to hear this.
No way. Meadows works. Okay. Meadows is at, I don't have the name in front of me, but Meadows is currently parked himself at a charity or a, you know, some kind of 501c3 advocacy organization that flogs the big lie. That's where Cleta Mitchell, the former Foley and Lardner partner, who was on the Georgia call, that's where she wound up. And not for nothing, Trump's PAC hasn't made a whole bunch of disbursements, but right before Meadows told the committee to get bent, he got $1 million. His organization, his anti-vote advocacy organization, or his, you know, vote security or whatever, vote integrity organization.
So hearing last week before Judge Mehta, what's your take on the situation?
Well, so Navarro's back in court. He was originally representing himself pro se, which was a gift for those of us who write about this on the regular. It was beautiful. He was like, he spent like a month spamming Judge Mehta's clerk with these pissy emails demanding like discovery on the FBI and,
with
you know, the date of the last
letters,
period of his, you know, the FBI agent who arrested him. It was just ridiculous. But it was beautiful. And then he would intersperse it with these appearances on Tucker Carlson, where he would say he was treated worse than Al-Qaeda. Like, you know, yeah, jail sucks. Welcome to the club. We also agree with you, but like, you know, you did do some crimes and that's a thing that happens. So, but eventually he did get lawyers and, you know, as you like to say, put a pin in it. I would like to know who is paying said lawyers, particularly since one of them, John Rowley, was recently hired to represent Trump as well. And one of the things that we've seen, because like we're not new here, is that they all kind of share lawyers and then they have these joint defense agreements and they all share all their information. And the person who's cutting the check tends to get visibility on everybody else's cases. So, you know, just something to consider. But anyway, now he's got counsel. And they appear to be competent. So.
Well, he does. And again, but it's baffling. Like, in addition to, right, you mentioned Rowley has shown up in this before. But lead counsel is John Irving from the Earth and Water Group,
right,
which, you know, as you might guess by the name, is an earth and water law firm, right? Like, they are in no way a white collar criminal defense firm. It just, I guess it stops feeling weird, right?
Like I'm sorry. Like,
they get whoever will cash the checks.
It's not just that. I mean, I think we've all like seen the lawyers who represent Trump, who is theoretically a billionaire, and he's got these like goofballs from Newsmax or One America News. So graded on the curve of like crazy lawyers, you know, or like John Cole, who represents, John Cole is Greta Van Susteren's husband and appears to be a retired insurance attorney. And he represents Trump in all of those tech suits against Google and Meta and Twitter. So, you know, this guy who appears to be a like lawyer in good standing and have relevant experience on the federal docket, like, I'm going to take that. I'm going to say that that's like a good lawyer in Trump land.
I stand suitably chastened, but wow. So, all right, what happens next?
Okay, so at this stage, Navarro is attempting to dismiss his case. He's filed a motion to dismiss for failure, you know, for failure to state a claim, and he's making the same arguments that Bannon made, plus some like extra crazy stuff. Like, he's decided that he has a right to be explained. He has a right for the January 6th committee to explain to him why it wants to talk to him and what legislative purpose his testimony could serve, which is like a thing that he made up. That's not a real thing, but, you know, perhaps for...
Well, you do have to show germaneness to the prosecution, but again, it's a very, very low standard.
Okay, but that's in that's a defense to a prosecution, right? That's not like something like when the subpoena comes to you, it has to have a note from Liz Cheney and Benny Thompson that says, like, here's why we want to talk to you. And by the way, there was one, because it said, like, yeah, you've written about all of this stuff and you participated in this coup plot. You should come and tell us.
He wrote a book.
Right. I mean, they did have a cover letter that explained that, but that's not a thing, like, that you're entitled to have a negotiation with Congress as to the pertinence of your testimony. Like, no, you made that up. But cool. Fanfic is fun for everybody. and he wants to do the malicious and selective prosecution claim. And he's still flapping his, yeah, at the same time that he's saying, I don't have to testify. He's going on television and saying, if Anthony Fauci doesn't testify, we're going to lock him up, when they take back the House.
They will. I mean, that's a true statement if we allow Republicans to get back in power. So, yeah.
Well, they'd have to take back the White House too, because I feel reasonably confident that
the DOJ would not accept that referral from the House subcommittee on making sure nothing gets done for 2 years while we run out the clock on the Biden administration.
Right.
Fair.
Right.
Fair.
So Navarro has made a bunch of other weird arguments. He's kind of baselessly accusing the Justice Department of misrepresenting the law to the grand jury, although he doesn't actually have any visibility on what the Justice Department said to the grand jury. He's accusing them in his filings of misrepresenting the law because of this, once again, the scienter requirement. He's saying that they only got the indictment by deceiving the grand jurors about whether he had to willfully defy Congress, which is another thing he made up. And he's also claiming that he's being maliciously prosecuted because the Biden administration doesn't like him, because he's constantly going on television and saying nasty things about them, which is, you know, not, there's no indication that's true.
That's the, we call that the, we can prosecute you for two reasons. Like, yeah.
Yeah. There's plenty of reasons to prosecute Navarro. I don't think that they have to, you know, lock him up for his screaming about nonsense on Tucker Carlson.
So, trial set for November 16th.
Right.
And we're just going to wait to watch Judge Mehta deny this motion to dismiss and the companion motion to compel discovery to do all sorts of stuff that he filed a couple of days ago and everything else related to that.
Yeah. Pack your toothbrush, buddy, and your Adderall.
I love it. Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We will come back and we have more on Steve Bannon after the jump. Hey, this is Andrew. This is an ad for MedCline. Does shoulder pain bother you at night, like when you're sleeping on your shoulder in a funny position? There's a solution that can bring real relief. It's the MedCline 3 component shoulder relief sleep system. Look, it's no medication, it's not woo, it's not crazy crap, it's not surgery. It's the MedCline sleep system. So you set it up on your side of the bed, you go to sleep. It's that simple. I use it because I sometimes suffer from shoulder pain in the middle of the night. So if you suffer from shoulder pain or nighttime acid reflux and GERD or both, the MedCline pillow system is designed to cushion your body in a sleeping position that is supremely comfortable. It is doctor recommended, clinically proven to provide effective natural acid reflux or shoulder pain relief, plus a better night's sleep. In fact, 95% of patients reported an overall improvement in sleep quality when using MedCline. MedCline has been validated in 7 independent clinical trials, partnering with leaders in sleep science like the Cleveland Clinic. So, MedCline sleep systems, they're not just the simple, cheap foam wedges. They are true medical devices. They are FDA registered, doctor recommended, clinically proven to provide relief. The patented arm pocket allows for comfortable side sleeping the entire night. And MedCline's medical grade gel infused foam is built to last and provides cooling comfort and an exceptional night's sleep for anyone using it. So now you can get 20% off when you go to MedCline.com/cleanup. So, get 20% off a better night's sleep today at MedCline.com/cleanup. That's today. Get 20% off MedCline.com/CLEANUP. MedCline.com/cleanup. All right, Liz. So turns out we are not done talking about Steve Bannon, who, as you noted, got convicted in July of the exact same crime that Peter Navarro was going to go to trial on in November. I think a lot of our listeners know because this is such a delightful story. But what's new in Bannon land?
So our buddy Bannon, old three shirts, was indicted recently, last week, in the Southern District of New York for conspiracy to commit wire fraud and conspiracy to commit money laundering in connection with this We Build the Wall scam, because they were going to crowdfund a border wall. They were just going to cook it up, homebrew, do it themselves.
I love everything about this. When this story first broke, we had Ace Associate Morgan Stringer dive into all of the perks that they were selling in connection with this crap. And it was just a gold mine of, like, you know, commemorative plates and t-shirts and soda filled with liberal tears. And
so get them?
What was your favorite purchase? We did not engage in any purchase, which is a shame because otherwise we could be a part of the civil lawsuit that inevitably is going to come on the heels of this conviction, because that's how plaintiff's lawyers tee them up. That was beautiful. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the day in which Steve Bannon was arrested federally a year ago in connection with this exact same scheme, because that was I hoisted a few beverages in connection with that one.
It was great. It was during the DNC, and the mailman arrested Steve Bannon on a yacht. It was so beautiful. It was the yacht belonging to this Chinese expat, Miles Kwok, who also has several other names. And China is trying to get us to extradite him back to China. But he's this kind of dissident Chinese billionaire who has funded a lot of Steve Bannon's activities. And so the U.S. Postal Service Inspections Service boarded this yacht and arrested Steve Bannon. And it was a thing of beauty.
It was so good. And it was the first time I think that people realized that the post office has its own police force. So
don't fuck with the mailman.
Yeah. Good. Always good advice. So let's talk a little bit about the ridiculousness of the underlying con, because this all hinges on, I guess, a guy who is now flipped from, because he's named in the federal indictment,
right,
and not named in the state indictment.
Well,
and by the way, should have put a pin in that. Well, not is an unindicted co-conspirator in the state indictment. And put a pin in. Can we scream about Alvin Bragg being a chicken shit prosecutor for an hour and a half?
I really try not to.
Okay.
But I think you should, because you're so good at it.
All right. So, anyway, that's a side note. Talk to me about WeBuildTheWall.com.
Oh, it was such a perfect manga grift specimen. It was like the grift. So they had this plan. They were gonna hit up the rubes, and I'm sorry for calling them rubes. We can call them deplorables, and I'm not really sorry. They were gonna hit up the rubes for cash through GoFundMe to build the wall. And they had this pitch man whose name was Brian Colfage, who is a veteran and a multiple amputee and is a really good pitch man. He's a good looking guy. His wife is beautiful. His kids are adorable. He very wholesome looking. But they decided that they would just like crank it up one extra notch by claiming that he was a volunteer and was just giving of his time, which to be fair, he was not. So they sent them all themselves a bunch of texts congratulating themselves for coming up with like this great plan to, as they put it, remove all self-interest taint on this. And they said it was going to be the most talked about media narrative ever. And it was going to give him Colfage the appearance of sainthood. And it did work. They weren't wrong. Yeah. They did manage to get, you know, to get $15 million from a bunch of like gullible donors. But in fact, Colfage wasn't unpaid and they weren't real subtle about it. They had a not particularly elaborate scheme of shell companies paying him $20,000 a month, like out the door. And you can see more, you have more visibility from the federal indictment, which as you said, that was, that included Colfage and a couple of the other co-conspirators. This one is against Bannon, and the New York indictment is just against Bannon because, as we'll explain, Colfage and the others have already been pled guilty, so they're now cooperating. But according to the federal indictment, Colfage wound up pocketing upwards of $350,000 in donated money, all while he was sending all of these texts and donation solicitations that refer to himself as an unpaid volunteer, just doing it out of love and, you know, love for excluding, starving migrants from the country. What a guy.
And we actually have GoFundMe's internal audits to thank for highlighting this prosecution, because they actually had to go back. So they raised more than $15 million. They had initially raised $20 million. But the problem was that they'd clicked the like automatic donation, and the line that was sent out was that their donations would be transferred to We Build the Wall under the, as the indictment notes, the false premise that, quote, 100% of fundraising through donations will only go towards the wall.
Right.
And that was not the case.
Not even remotely the case. In fact,
Colfage was paid $100,000 up front, even before the $20,000 a month. So,
yeah. And everybody, it appears, from the federal indictment. Now, it's not in the state indictment, but the federal indictment said that Bannon, through his own nonprofit, took in $1 million, and some of that went to Colfage. But according to the federal indictment, Bannon used a substantial proportion of these donor funds for personal uses and expenses unrelated to building to We Build a Wall. I assume he went and got a facial, or maybe not. Maybe not.
Oh, well, you and I have both followed the career of one Terpsichore Maris. So the ideal use for a fake charity is, of course, bikini waxing and Twizzlers. But
I cannot believe you made me think about Steve Bannon getting a bikini wax.
There you go. You will never come back on Clean Up on I-45. But thanks for sticking it out for this episode.
So. Yeah. So anyway, these guys never heard of the Stringer Bell rule because they were definitely taking notes on a motherfucking conspiracy. And they send each other just all of these texts like, I will move the money and we will go to move it out the back door. So like Bannon texts one of his partners in January of 2019, we need a wire of cash to unindicted co-conspirator entity number one, to which his partner responded, K. And then Bannon sent another text.
To be fair, that's how my son responds to my text.
I mean, and that is fine, but presumably you're not sending your son a text that's like, let's do crimes. And your son is like, K, right? Like,
Not yet, anyway.
Right. Hey, how about some money laundering? K. And in fact, one of their companies was named White Knights and Vultures LLC, because of course it was. Like, these guys are such a caricature of themselves.
It's so good. So the one kind of legal question that I think is sort of hanging out there is, all right, if this is the exact same conduct, grifting the exact same people for which a bunch of people already went to federal prison, why how is it possible that don't we have a double jeopardy rule? And the answer there is dual sovereigns, right? Like it's really, really simple. If your conduct can be prosecuted in a different forum, and here it violates state as well as federal law, then the doctrine of overlapping sovereigns allows differing state prosecutors to bring essentially the same charges against the same person for the same set of crimes. That was the subject of a potential change to the New York law, because New York had a very weird interpretation of the dual sovereigns doctrine. But so that's how we can go get Steve Bannon twice for the same crime. So,
and
I love it.
To be fair, Bannon's jeopardy didn't attach the last time, right? Because Bannon was never tried, because he got a pardon literally on January 20th, 2021. Which Colfage and the rest of them didn't get. Like Bannon got his ticket punched, but he didn't get a ticket punched for Colfage.
So if you're wondering why Colfage went from being a co-defendant to being unindicted co-conspirator number one, probably, hey, if there's a pardon list, I'd like to be on it. I'm not on that? Okay, well then, you know, fuck that guy. And that would be my interpretation of events. Yours may differ.
No, I would agree with you. And were I in Colfage's position, I also might have a bone to pick with my former buddy, Steve.
So I imagine, of course, now, all right, Steve Bannon has been suitably cowed. He's going to just go away, plead this out, and we'll all be saved the spectacle of watching. No, that's not going
to
happen.
You have a fevered imagination, sir.
Yeah, I do. What's going on?
So Steve Bannon, being Steve Bannon, handled this in the most Steve Bannon way possible. So he puts out this crazy statement the other day before he's about to be in, you know, have to turn himself in. And he says, I'm never going to stop fighting. I have not yet begun to fight. They will have to kill me first.
We
will fight them on the beaches. The next day, he like obediently toddles in to the courthouse and, you know, gets fingerprinted and the whole thing, because he's
voluntarily surrenders. Because of course. Yeah, exactly.
So that's going to be fun. I think his next court date's in October. Cannot wait.
All right. So wrap all this up. It's not great to be 2022 and a former buddy of Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe some consequences are coming for folks who have mostly managed to skate by unscathed.
Fucking around's fun, but finding out sucks.
Well, I couldn't put it any better than that. So, Liz, thank you so much for coming on the show today. You are at $5 Feminist. That's the number 5, at $5 Feminist on Twitter. You got the byline at Wonkette. Anything else we want to plug?
Above the law.
Yeah. Oh, and of course, abovethelaw.com. So, Liz, your stuff is outstanding. Everybody should be reading it. And thank you so much for coming on Clean Up on Aisle 45.
Thanks, Andrew.
Clean Up on Aisle 45 is written, researched, and produced by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres, with editing by Molly Hockey. Our art and logo designer by Joelle Reeder and Moxie Design Studios, and our music is composed and performed by Adam Orr. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com.
Hi, I'm Harry Littman, host of Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent figures from government law and journalism for a dynamic discussion of the most important topics of the day. Each Monday, I'm joined by a slate of Feds favorites and new voices to break down the headlines and give the insider's view of what's going on in Washington and beyond, plus sidebars explaining important legal concepts read by your favorite celebrities. Find Talking Feds wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, show me in a courtroom how we were at war.
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing in the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.